Just to quickly review where we've been, the journey that we've been on together. And just out of curiosity, is there anybody in the room who's been at all five sessions? All right, so there's a little bit of memory there.
As did to they the... get a star?
Just curious. Right. Just a quick review of where we've been. We started out by talking about the dynamics of racism and shared with you a model that suggested that at least racism was both a sociologically institutionalized reality, but it was also a spirit force. That is, it was a mode of consciousness. It was a mythology about life. And that those dynamics worked together and had a lot of power in our society. And that racism is a persisting, present force in our contemporary life that, as a matter of fact, seems to be on the upsurge, both in the United States and in related forms around the world. Then secondly, we talked about environmental racism as an illustration, an example of institutionalized racism, and shared with you some examples and shared with one another our own experiences of various examples in our situation of environmental racism. And then thirdly, we stepped back, and for the next two sessions, we looked more broadly at the historical scope and began to retell the story of the journey of the Americas from the perspective of people of color, and also beginning to get a hold of the underlying stories about racial differences. And continued that last night as we looked more directly at the mythology of racial superiority and talked about how it played itself out in our history, in brief, in broad brushstrokes. And then finally this morning, we want to turn and ask the question of, all right, now what about us good folk, those who follow Jesus? Clear as we are, relatively speaking, about the dynamics of racism, clear as we are that we participate in racism, but at the same time we understand that there's other possibilities, what is our role? What is our task as those both in and yet with the capacity to see beyond the dynamics of institutionalized racism? And our intention was to develop a sense of a journey together, a kind of a spiraling journey where each session perhaps we dug a little bit deeper. And at the same time we also worked, we didn't tell you this before, but we worked to weave through each session and all of the sessions a liturgical theme or liturgical dynamics. And our concern the first two sessions was what you might call confession, the experience of confession. And then the second two sessions, we worked on the experience of praise. And then finally, the last session today, we're going to work on the experience or the motif of dedication. We suspect that those are the underlying motifs in the Christian liturgy. And so we tried to weave those through even each of our sessions so that in each session, there was the dynamic of confession, praise, and dedication. But this morning, then, we'll turn and look more directly at the church, how it grasps its relationship to the institutionalized dynamics of racism, and what our task is. Yeah.
Well, we're assuming that the tape is rolling, and this is Nadine Addington, for some of you who are joining us for the first time. And I want to talk in two major ways about how we're going to look at this area of the church, the gospel, and the social action that we're going to get at. And first of all, which one of these pens works the best on this board? Is that blue one?
They all work. The blue one works good, the black one works good.
Is to look at the no longer. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute, and talk about what I mean by the no longer, is that life is a continual flow onward. You can use terms like evolution and the continuation of how life began, and then things kind of die off and then changes are made. That's what I mean by the continual flow of life. And an image to help us get at that is, I don't know if there's scientists in the room or not, but you know about the the development of our butterflies. Well, it first came from a cocoon, something crawling around on the ground. Eventually it sprouted wings and looked all funny and strange, didn't it? And then it wasn't recognized anymore as that little funny little cocoon worm or whatever. But we're in a time like that. We're in a time where things are no longer working for us. Our structures are no longer working for us. Our educational system needs revitalization. Our family systems are in transition. Our family values, our picture of the family, different types of things like that. But that's how history is created. When something is no longer working and it has fulfilled its role, you stop and it gets changed. I don't mean just simplistically stop, because we know how we feel about change. As human beings, we don't jump at the chance to change, especially when we've been comfortable. Now, last night, I know that that was a very uncomfortable exercise for everybody in this room, and including me. But I have heard that stuff before, and you have heard that stuff before, and you knew it existed, but it still made you angry when you heard it again, didn't it? And you didn't like it. Well, folks, neither do the people that we were talking about like it either. It's like enough is enough. Enough is enough. We have all been sold a bill of goods where the merchandise has been damaged and the price is incorrect. You buy that?
Yes.
Yeah, I do too. And I'm tired. Are you tired?
Yes.
Well, we're tired of talking about it, and people are tired of experiencing it. And that's what I mean. It's no longer acceptable for us to look at one another in the ways we have been looking at one another. We have to shake off these ancient prejudices and build a new earth. And we were doing that through the exercises. That's why we were taking it so deep and trying to figure out all the places that this was showing up. And this is what I mean by the no longer not working. The structures are outmoded. All those things that we put into place need to change. You just need to change. This represents structures. Don't mind my artwork here. We need new ways of relating to each other and bringing in a new generation. Now, we mentioned before this. There was someone had said they had seen the movie Roots way back in the 70s, I guess it was. I mean, about 1977, 76, something like that?
1970, I believe.
Okay. And now we have a whole generation, about 10 to 20 years span, as those children were born in the 80s and now coming in the 90s. How do we continue to bring something like Roots to their attention instead of worrying about the specific date and historical event of something that happened 300, 400, I don't know, BC, whatever, when to make it relevant for their times? How do we want to do that? What kinds of things do we put in place? Well, we have to look at our education system. I'm going to step on the other side of this in just a second. That's a form of socialization. We are socialized through our educational system. Another way is through our communities. What kinds of communities are we in now? And then that's where I want to bring in how the different people in this group and coming here at Holden show up from different congregations, because your congregation is like a microcosm of society. You get a little of everybody together. Holden appears to be that way to me this first week especially. And that's where you want to look at. How are our communities socializing each other? Now, other cultures do the same thing. It's not an abstract dynamic. Other cultures socialize as people for its people. I mean, if you take the business of language and religion, those are identifiable things of cultures. So it's not like anybody is bad for doing the socialization process. That's how you build a people. And then if you look at the aesthetic nature of culture, which is the secondary thing, you learn a lot about different cultures through their music, through their drama, through their poetry, through their movies, whatever. And that's a form of socialization. It's the question of what kind. What are we saying about humanists and that? And I think we live in a time of God's great judgment and mercy. And that's an interesting little twist there. You know, the judgment is a crisis. It's the things that hurt. It's the things that make silent people yell out and say, no more. Los Angeles was a judgment call. It is saying, we are tired, we are fed up of being alienated, and there you have the response that you did. But all along, it was the mentality that was building up to that situation. And what I mean is, as long as you tell people they're no good, they can't be educated, and all those things you read before, and then you set them up in a situation where they can't even get basic needs, you're going to have angry people. You're going to have them respond somewhere along the line because they have been conditioned. You understand the conditioning process there? And then you set up a situation where you put them, this is back to the Los Angeles situation, just a minute. You put them in a setting, and I'm talking about the people experiencing the brutality, and then they wanted an objective judgment or use our judicial system, but you put them in all white jewelry in a place where they thought they could get adequate law processes and everything. That was a setup. Did anybody think that there was going to be something different from that verdict at all? When you had it just kind of, if I can use the word, whitewashed, all set up like that? And I'm using these words because next week we're going to work on how we're going to stop using this kind of language of whitewashes and blacklists and everything else. But anyway, when you think about that, how devastating that was, and it caught everybody's attention. I mean, everybody, all those fine little communities that thought, oh my God, we never thought of anything could happen like that. And in St. Paul, they were thinking the same thing. Oh, could this ever happen in St. Paul? Yes. It can happen in all our fine little communities that we come from. That's the judgment. The mercy is, my God, open your eyes and your ears and hear. We're in a time where our eyes and ears need to be open, and we start thinking from our hearts. We learned what it's like to think from our minds. Let's start thinking from our hearts. And what I mean by that is that all of us, we didn't have to know Rodney King, but we felt the pain that Rodney King felt. Somewhere along the line, it jarred our attention, and it kept us listening to the news to see what the next steps were. And that's just an inkling into what could happen if we continue to allow what we've discovered no longer works to stay in place. And I'm talking about systems and policies and the unconscious way in which we deal with one another in our society. Now, this is a huge thing, this structure business, right? It takes a lot to put them in place. Somebody, well-meaning, long ago, whatever, drew up plans for those structures. Several people. But what I'm saying with that now, it has played its role. It has played out. How do we redo or change dramatically our decision-making processes? And I'm going to step over on to the other side. Because what we're living now with the no longer is to step out beyond that and create the not yet. Okay. What do you mean by not yet? Well, I mean we need new symbols. We need new language. And the English language, as well as its place, is somewhat limited. It cannot grasp the beauty and the richness of other cultures when you try to translate everything. So we may have to learn a new language from a different culture in order to figure out what it means to be human and how we relate to one another. That's what I mean. We need new symbols. Just for instance, just think one minute. If when we were born, we had this image of the world as a living organism. Just think one minute. What kind of other images could catch our imagination if we thought the world was a living organism? Anybody? Can you think of anything? The organism being somewhat like your body.
The organism is injured and dying.
Yeah, but what if we had that image before we had this business of all the continents and all these boundaries, what kind of pictures of the world would we have? What ways would we begin to think about it?
One piece. Are we connected?
One piece. We're connected.
Different people filling different roles in different parts of the world, playing different parts.
Okay.
Be
a kind of interdependence. Yeah.
Staying healthy.
We would have to be fed. We'd figure it out, though, wouldn't we? That's what that little blue marble picture comes to mind for me with the moonshot of that. If thinking of the world as a living organism. That's the, in a sense, to step into the not yet. And then we would confront the systems and structures that we needed to have in place a little bit differently. We begin to construct them differently, wouldn't we? One of the things that we know over here, the way the decisions were made, back here in my triangle, was that there were a few on top. But who was mostly affected were the masses. What would be a kind of new image of how decision making would go on if we had this image of the earth as a living organism? How would decisions then be made, if you can imagine what that's like?
Turn the pyramid upside down.
Okay, that would be one way.
What about a circle?
Complete.
Yeah.
Okay, and who would be in that circle?
All the masses, everyone.
Isn't that interesting? Now, I want to step into how these changes come about, because there are some people that finally come forth on our behalf thinking about this kind of a role of living out here on the not yet, as like pioneers or just those unsung, unknown heroes, heroines, whoever they are, finally step out and begin to take the chance of building something like this. And I want to suggest that has been a prophetic role of the church. And by that, I'm talking about looking again at that community that shows up from all walks of life, looking for those people, those masses of people who begin to open their eyes, open their ears, and begin to hear in different ways and see in different ways about that. And I want to share two friends with you about this prophetic role of the local church. And first of all, this is another resource book, The Prophetic Imagination, that Walter Brueggemann is the author of. That's going to be on our list. But I'd like to read something to you from his book on the prophetic imagination, just briefly. Now, he says, and this is the area to offer symbols. To offer symbols that are adequate to the horror and massiveness of the experience, which evokes numbness and requires denial. And he's talking about offering new symbols here. And then another point is to bring to public expression those everyday fears and terrors that have been denied so long and suppressed so deeply that we do not know that they are there. Bring those out to make people become aware. And then to speak metaphorically, but concretely, about the real deathliness that hovers over us and gnaws within us, and to speak neither in rage nor in cheap grace, but the candor born of anguish and passion. Now that's his suggestion on the prophetic role. And another area I'd like to share with you is how to do that. Pages here. Now he's talking about how do you bring about the awareness and then begin to turn your back upon and then to step into the new. What we have to do is to continuously speak out now that this awareness has come to the forefront, knowing that the things do no longer work, and to push for change, But abolishing it within is a more difficult one, I know, because that means that we have to start saying no to the kinds of things that we hear. And that means relationships will begin to change, your friendships will begin to change, and people will look at you a little differently. They don't want to respond in that way. They like it being comfortable. And then how do you start to lead in spite of that reality? And that's when you're stepping out here into the not yet. And it's in the church that we have to look again at the way that the structure of the church, of our local congregations. How do they become aware when we know that there are some hard and fast ways to be good church folk, right? And then we have to see how we can change within our structures of our different denominations to lead society. As the dynamic of what Niebuhr talks about as being the social pioneer, that is abolishing within, turning our back upon, and then leading society. And then stepping out and leading society in its thinking, organization, and its action. That's the social action part. What Niebuhr's talking about is of the dynamic of the church is those few steps I've just mentioned. And we need to become aware in our action and our thinking of how do we discern when changes need to be made. Well, innocent suffering is a clue. Innocent suffering is a very strong clue. And what we're experiencing and seeing in our society today is a lot of innocent suffering. Children, elders, you name it. The disenfranchised, the marginalized, everyone that's not included in that circle, in a sense, are the ones who are experiencing the innocent suffering due to our ways of thinking and action that has no longer worked for us in our society. We have to move this way or else we end up being relevant and you get a lot of turmoil and you get a lot of anger and you get a lot of situations, more so like L.A. and actually, beyond L.A., we can see it going on in other countries so vividly and so brutally. So it's a time to build. And I want to share with you Joseph Barnes' thinking about that time. It's a time for us to dismantle all that baggage that we have been carrying around with us in so long and start building a new world, start building a new society, and daring to take the chance to do that. So I want to share with you what he is suggesting as that an inoculation, I want to call it, for building that new society. And this is in the category of his book, Becoming Aware of Our Brokenness. Before leaving the subject of individual racism, we must emphasize the crucial role of the church, that the church can play in helping us to break through our anesthesia. This is probably the church's most important task in dealing with racism. The process we have called de-anesthetization is helping people to become aware of their brokenness as a result of racism. Now that's the breaking through of it in order to build the new. And then in his section on a time to build the new, he says, we will need more reminders that we cannot build a pluralistic society without tearing down the walls of racism. However, this same reminder must be turned around and stated inversely. We cannot tear down the walls without the intention and commitment to build new communities that are inclusive and pluralistic in its nature. Now, that's basically what I wanted to share with you. And we have the task, should we decide to pick up this task, according to Tullier Deschardins, of building this new earth and moving on into the future of the next century. We're not too far away from that, about 8 years. As a matter of fact, it's probably fast approaching in our thinking and organization. Now, before I move to the workshop, just think of it. What would it be like in our decision-making process to include more players than have been before, and ways that we can do that. Not necessarily that you answer that, just begin to think about those questions. What would it be like to have our educational system be a representation of our plurality and diversity in our society? What would it be like to have our church leadership to represent our diversity and our plurality in our society? Anyway, questions, comments?
Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Well, we'd like to pick up on the challenge Nadine has given us and share with you a worksheet that helps us begin to think maybe a bit more practically about the local congregation and how to begin some of the work within that gears us up then to do the work without in our communities. Now, what do we as the church bring to this enterprise? Well, it seems to me that there are at least three gifts that we bring to deal with social challenges. One of those gifts is a sense of history and an understanding of the cruciality of historical memory. That's especially important in our society because, as Henry Ford used to say, and all of us subscribe to more or less, history is bunk. And that's pretty much what Americans believe. But the church, the Judeo-Christian community, has a deep grasp of the importance of historical memory. That's one of the gifts we bring to this challenge. Another gift that we bring is a deep understanding of community. And what's really interesting is we bring that understanding of community in a time when the European philosophy of individualism is running rampant. When the old American sense of entrepreneurship has become distorted to an understanding of everything for me. We bring a deep understanding of community and how we are bound together. We may need to work a bit to recover that. And the third gift that perhaps we as the Judeo-Christian community bring is a deep appreciation and understanding of the, how would you put it, the presence of awe in everyday life, the presence of mystery in everyday life, and the understanding that mystery will intrude upon your ordered universe when least expected, and the people of faith are the ones who respond to that. Those gifts give us the tools we need to respond to the challenge of racism and other challenges that our times present us with also. Nadine suggested that one of the people that we've looked to for guidance has been Richard Niebuhr, who was Reinhold Niebuhr's brother and a first-rate theologian in his own right. And in his struggle to get clear on the role of the church as community in the historical situation, he talked about repentance. And that if you look back particularly to the prophetic heritage, it suggests to us that the church's role in relation to social challenges is to lead in the act of social repentance. But in order to do that, we have to abolish within ourselves the structures of evil which innocent suffering has in our society. If we take racism as an example of where we see innocent suffering revealed, then we think about our congregations. How is it that we abolish within ourselves the vestiges of institutionalized racism? Well, we've developed a little worksheet to help us think along those lines. And I want to take a couple of minutes to walk you through it, and then to have you work for a bit to get a feel for it in small groups. We call this the Abolishing Within Worksheet. And you can see that it's a kind of a matrix laid out in two directions. Niebuhr suggested that when the church, in its thinking, organization, and action, functions as a world society undivided by race and clan, the deed of Christ is reduplicated in the life of the church. And history has changed. Well, and so we've used those categories, thinking, organization, and action. And then down the side are what we call pressure points. We want to use this sheet to help you think about your congregations and want to suggest that as you work in small groups, that you identify, for the sake of working together, three pressure points of change within the life of your congregation, not in your community, but in your congregation. Now, what do I mean by a pressure point? Well, those of you who stay year-round up here in the mountains may know of the old story. I don't know if it's an old wives' tale or an old man's tale or something about, you know, when the passes get laden with snow, it becomes dangerous. And so somebody goes and stands at a particular point and fires a gun or shouts, and it triggers an avalanche. That's a pressure point. Where are the places in your congregational life that if you press, you'll trigger an avalanche of change? I think there are some strong clues. Well, we want you to think about that for a moment and name three pressure points in your congregation that if you focus on those pressure points, whether it's indirect or direct, there's going to start to be some winds of change sweeping through the life of the congregation. And take each one of those pressure points through thinking, organization, and action. Now, thinking. Talk about the life of your congregation for a moment. What might that category have to do with thinking within your congregation? What dimension of congregational life would thinking have to do with? Yes, speak up.
Sermon.
All right, the sermon certainly. Preaching, what else?
Classes,
yes.
Adult ed.
Yes, indeed. Adult ed, Sunday's children's classes, the whole education program. Mm-hmm. That has to do with our thinking. Anything else?
Repetitions and prayers.
Okay, yes, indeed. Very interesting, isn't it? The way you can begin to impact the imagination of the congregation by simply being intentional about your petitions and intercessions and the prayers. Now, organization. What dimension of congregational life might that deal with?
Leadership.
Beg your pardon?
Leadership.
All right. Leadership, yes. Your leadership development, leadership organization.
Task forces,
yes indeed.
Events. Themed events.
Okay.
Long-range planning.
All right. Planning, yes indeed. Action. Now within the congregation, what might that relate to?
Worship.
Worship, okay, yes.
Where you send your money.
All right. Yes, indeed. How you use your money? Okay, anything else?
Your buildings.
Your buildings, okay. This is going to press you a bit, and we don't have a lot of time. This is the sort of thing you'd like to take at least an hour in a small group to do some working, people from the same congregation. Mm-hmm. Now, not too many of you are probably from the same congregation, but don't let that faze you. Mm-hmm. I want to suggest that we work in little groups of probably no more than 8. How many are upstairs? 1, 2, 3, 4... 5, 6, well that's a good size working group. And then the folks down here can form little groups of 6 to 8. And you can just pretty much organize yourselves. And we have enough of these sheets to go around. Now we share this sheet with you as a tool that you can take back and adapt and use as is helpful to you. And if for whatever reason you decide you don't want it, why leave it and we'll use it, you know, the next time around. If a couple of you need to look on together, well, that's all right. You can make a pencil copy of it to take back with you.
Did you want to give them some time?
Yes. I'm going to check with you in about 12 minutes to see what's happening.
It was hard to distinguish. I thought our group found it very hard to distinguish between pressure points and issues. Very difficult. What is a pressure point and what is an issue? Because I know there's a lot of issues that are pressure points.
Certainly a lot of issues are causing a lot of pressure in the congregation. Here we were really wanting you to look at the social fabric of the congregation and pick out the points of congregational life where if you pay attention to those and work on those, you can catalyze change in other dimensions of the congregation's life. Think again of the image of the snow on the passes in the wintertime. You stand at the right place and shout loud enough, you can trigger an avalanche. That's what a pressure point is. And for me, the budget process would certainly be a pressure point. Certainly liturgy would be. That's the sacred cow of most congregations.
Awesome.
You fiddle around with the liturgy. So, you know, it requires, you have to be wily as serpents. Isn't that somewhere? Didn't I hear that somewhere? Anyway, you got to be very, very intelligent, you know, smart. And that means you're going to have a group thinking together. Somebody give me an illustration of what you came up with thinking in terms of the liturgy.
Well,
And the thinking has to do with creating awareness and envisioning the new. That was Brueggemann's two dimensions of the prophetic imagination. You express the pain that's so difficult that you paste it over and become numb. Give me an example of your thinking in relation to liturgy. What would you do?
Explain the elements of it more.
All right. I'd do more work in helping people understand the elements of the liturgy.
History and introduce new ideas.
Okay.
With explanation.
Okay. What about the budget, organization? What might you do there? What was one of your to-dos?
Include more people in working on
broader base,
more inclusive.
Broader base participation in creating the budget priorities.
If it's too small of a group, it will never change.
Yes, indeed. All right. Social ministry. What was one of your action?
Integrating interracial concerns into, in my congregation at least, integrating Native American concerns and immigrant concerns into our social action, rather than deciding as a homogeneous white congregation what the correct social action is. Maybe go to Native groups and have them be a part of our decisions about social action.
All right, involve those on whose behalf you intend to work.
Right.
In working out your mode of operation and your plans. Okay.
Like mission, yes.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay.
Great.
Well, if you begin to brood in terms of what it would mean for your congregation to be the leavening dynamic in your community, to be the catalytic dynamic and the teaching dynamic in your community, you know, images like that begin to seed your imagination. And then, you know, you sit down somewhere in a back room or off on a retreat with a small group who have similar concerns, and all kinds of exercises you can do like this one to help you begin to think about the places in the congregation that you can begin to fine-tune and turn this and open that, and change can begin to flow. Our time is nearly up. Nadine wants to share one other little bit with you.
We wanted to give you a lot of tools, but we only had a few to share. But specifically, this one to take with you as individuals. And it's a resource we found from A World of Difference called A Personal Commitment. And this is something that you could do on your own. After you read it, it's a pledge. And the pledge is supporting a world of difference for building a new world. So we have these pledges up here you can read through, and they will begin to feed your imagination once again about how to become aware and then combat racism and deal with that. That's available to you. And then I have been asked several times about our bibliography and resources. What I'd like to do, what we both like to do, is get your name and address on this sheet, and when we go back to St. Paul a week from now, we will pull that together and then mail it back to you.
If you're interested in our reading list.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So this is available to you. So we're done for.
Well, why don't we pass those out?
Well, I was going to let them walk up, see if they pick it up, and then they could sign it too.
If we distribute them, we may be more sure that everybody's going
to. Now, do we have to go through the thinking process for this?
Yes.
And we want you to sign this and give it to us, and then in 3 months we're going to visit you and see. No, actually, just to share this as a resource with you, it's even got some contact names for videos, resource materials, and so on that you might use. And if there are extras, we'll use them next week. Oh, let me have a few and I'll pass them upstairs.
You can sign.
I do have
them.
Okay. I'll get it down there.
I'll get it down there.
May I use your pen for a minute,
though? Thank you for being a part of this series.
Thank you.